The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's another special. Today I'm having a conversation with Dr. Catherine Mannix, who's written a book with the end in mind, Dying, Death and Wisdom in an Age of Denial. Dr. Catherine Mannix has spent her medical career working with people who have incurable advanced illnesses, starting in cancer care and changing...
Are you reading the book?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Starting in cancer care.
You were talking like a robot.
And changing careers to become a pioneer, a new discipline of palliative medicine. She's worked as a palliative care consultant in teams in hospitals, and in patients and homes, optimising quality of life, even as death is approaching. Now, what's fascinating about this podcast is it was recommended by one of our listeners, who contacted me.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Oh, yeah, contacted me on Twitter and said, you should interview Catherine Mannix.
Oh, well done, our listener.
Yeah, and copied me in on it. And I'll dig out her details and we'll do it in the outro. But, yeah, she copied me in on it, and Catherine, I spoke to Catherine, she said she wanted to do it. I read this book, Mark, and I've got to tell you that I read it and I just started crying because it's about death, and it really touched me and moved me. I talk on this podcast quite a lot about my brother, and I apologise for that,
Why are you apologising?
Just because I think, I don't know, it's just, I feel I might have talked about him a little bit too much. However, it was from my experiences, that's how I could hold the conversation about death and bereavement.
But that's what conversations are. They're about sharing your experiences. So I wouldn't apologise for that.
The book brought back memories of my brother dying. He died when he was, for anyone who doesn't know, he died when he was of a pancreatic cancer when he was 37 years old. I was there when he died, and I watched the last bit of it. She talks all about how we've sort of moved so far away from death, it's become a real taboo for us to talk about, and she doesn't want it to be like that anymore. So she wants us to be able to actually engage and talk about death. The death rate's still 100%, as she points out constantly. So it's a fascinating conversation. Did you enjoy it, Mark?
I did. Well, I mean, enjoy is that the word?
Well, it's a fascinating conversation.
Yes.
It really is. And I'll leave you to listen to it, but we've got a couple of sponsors, so let's talk about those. The first one is, Mark, you know, when I get older, the thing that I like more...
That's a lovely gear change.
This is true, though. The thing, when I'm older, the thing I like more is beer, Mark. And I don't know why, but I just...
I'm not really...
yeah, right. I just now you know that when you're a kid, you have to really struggle to drink beer to begin with.
It's the most disgusting thing in the world when you're a kid.
I just love the taste now. What I like about
it looks so good when you're a kid, though. I remember drinking, you know those old pub benches?
Yeah.
They have like the chair, they have like the table and the two bench seats, you know, attached to it. And I remember, I have a distinct memory of saying to my dad, can I try your beer? And him saying, you're not going to like it. But it's got the little ice cream head, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And an interesting colour.
Well, and, you know, when I started drinking beer, like everybody, I became a binge drinker. I don't do that anymore. I just like to just drink a nice, just tasty beer now, and I look so forward to it. I'm one of those guys now who walks into a bar, looks at all the what do you call them, the pumps,
beer
pumps, and then choose which one I want excitedly. Oh, yes. I'll try that one. Generally a pale ale or something like that. Anyway, how would you like a free case of craft beer?
Yes, sorry.
Would you like one, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I thought you were talking to me.
Well, as a listener to our show, we'd like to thank you for listening with the help of our friends at beer52.com, who are one of our sponsors. You just have to go to beer52.com/lovejoy, and you can claim a free case of beer, the perfect chance to get special beers in. Now, what they do is they go around the world finding different exciting beers, and it's one of these subscription services. So you, once a month, will get 8 beers, and they're 8 different beers. This month, I believe, is still Korea month. I better check that, but I think it still is Korea month. And so they've been to Korea and all around there, and they actually went to North Korea as well. I know the guy who runs the company had a lovely chat with him all about it. And you subscribe and you will get, every month, you'll get 8 bottles of beer from around the world. You'll also get their magazine, which is called Ferment, and you'll get a snack as well. And as a one-off offer, if you subscribe, you will get one lot for free, but you do pay postage and packaging, which is $5.95. So you can get 8 craft beers, $5.95, and then you just have to cancel after that if you don't want it. That's all you have to do. If you do want it, you
simple.
Just go. It's, yeah, it's as simple as that. So that's it. And it's nice. Mark and I have tried a load of them. It's really good. I'm also on a chocolate subscription service as well. That is brilliant as well. When they arrive.
Well, I don't think you should talk about it. They're not a sponsor, Tim.
Oh, yeah. Who was it the other day on my show told me about a cheese subscription service? How cool would that be when the cheese arrives? Cheese, chocolate, beer, all the great things. Right, so if you want to claim your free one anyway, beer52.com/lovejoy. Beer52.com/lovejoy. We're also sponsored by one of my favourite all-time inventions.
Beer?
It is a more gadget, say. Let's say gadget. One of my all-favourite. I reckon it's in my top 10. It's the cooker. Spelt quooker, Q-U-O-O-K-E-R, but pronounced cooker. It is hot water.
You can spell that, but you can't spell beer.
Exactly right. And I just love it. As I say, in my top 10, I reckon, what else is in my top 10? I'd go for the lights in my house, the central heating. I'd go for the cooker as well. Oh, maybe the dishwasher. That's good.
Internet? Toilet?
Yeah, you've got a lot now, aren't you? They're adding up. Anyway, cooker's up there. Definitely up there. Boiling hot water straight out of the tap, 100 degrees boiling water. Plus also on it, you can get hot water, you can get your filtered cold water as well, and you can have it all in a combi tap, so it all comes out of the one tap. Absolutely fantastic. It's saving water, energy, money and time, and it's far safer than a kettle. What's a kettle? Oh, what is a kettle? I'm living in the future. I've got myself a cooker. No kitchen is... I tell you what, if I was getting a new kitchen now, the first thing I'd do is do the cooker. Actually, probably go for the cooker than
the cooker. The
cooker. Cooker, spelt cooker, but pronounced cooker. Cooker.co.uk. Go there for all the details. I love it. I use it for all my cooking, and I also use it for all my hot drinks.
Think how quickly you can make a pot noodle.
Yeah, I've not made a... God, when was the last time you had a pot noodle?
Many, many moons ago.
It's just the vegetables. I don't know how people... Because, you know, people have to put cold water on, don't they? But the cooker, you just put your hot water straight in for your vegetables. And it's best for making cups of tea. And just start it off and goes... That's it, yeah. Speaking of which, we just had a chat with Catherine Mannix just before she left, and she was talking about cups of tea, and there's 42 mentions of cups of tea in the book and only 30 patients, so there's more.
Talking of sponsorship, she missed it. She missed a trick there. She should have got some sort of sponsorship deal.
Yeah, she should have done. Yeah. Also at the beginning of it, I think there's, if you were watching on the YouTube, there was a bit of was there? Oh, no.
No, I've edited that out.
Oh, have you?
But I will say, we had a couple of problems technically today. So I've had to use the backup audio, which means I can't mix the levels. So I had to compress it. It's going to bore, it sounds boring, but it just means it's going to sound slightly different to how it normally sounds. But it's still the same great content.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Let's meet her. Here's Catherine Mannix.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into dear Lovejoy.
Catherine, thank you very much for coming and welcome to my kitchen.
Thank you.
I've got your present. Like always, I thought, what can I buy Catherine? We're going to discuss death. Obviously, I've got to buy her tea. So I bought you posh tea, but it's sort of not English tea, it's berry tea. And I bought you posh biscuits as well.
Oh,
there you go.
You're
so I thought it would probably be something that is integral to your life, tea and biscuits.
It's absolutely a palliative care tea break. Or it's, well, what I like to say is that it's the thing that turns a consultation into a conversation. If you have it over a cup of tea, it just changes the dynamics completely.
I always wonder what people in other countries do. We have tea. It's such a big thing for us, isn't it? Whenever, I know you're aware, my brother died, but whenever anyone came round, the Macmillan nurses, or anything ever happened, it was like, let's all sit and have a cup of tea whilst we do this. It just seems to be the thing which means we're all right to sit and talk now. We've all got a cup of tea in our hands. It's such a bizarre thing, isn't it? Ceremony for us all.
It is ceremony, isn't it? It's a kind of ritual, but it's doing something really important, I think, which is saying, we're people here.
Do you think that's it?
Yeah, I think it's saying there isn't a hierarchy in this room.
Right.
We are sitting here being people to each other.
Mm.
And so in the context of a palliative care conversation, we're saying, okay, so we may be bringing expertise, but we're not bringing egos and being experts. We're bringing ourselves, and you are experts in the situation that you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And let's pool the expertise to make the best we can of this.
Explain palliative, what it means.
Pallium is the Latin for a cloak.
Oh,
okay.
That's
so
good.
Cloak and dagger science. So palliative care is about cloaking the symptoms of an illness if you can't make the illness better. That's all it is, really. It doesn't have to be a terminal illness. You don't have to be on your deathbed. But most illnesses are most well tolerated by making them better. So there's that group of people where treatment isn't curing them, where the next important thing then is to manage the symptoms that they're having.
So basically it's you're there to help people as they die, to make sure that they're comfortable.
Okay, I think the palliative care community would kill me if I didn't start by saying you're not obliged to die if you see the palliative care team.
Right.
Okay, and that's really, really important.
Yeah.
Because it prevents people from agreeing to a palliative care referral if they think that in some magical way that then is the first step towards dying.
Yeah.
Actually, what we like to think is palliative care is the first step towards living less miserably during whatever phase of your life you're
right.
in.
Okay.
Now, it happens that because we're experts in symptom management, which is where it all started with Cicely Saunders and St. Christopher's Hospice in trying to manage the symptoms of advanced cancer, we do see people who are approaching the ends of their lives more often than any other group of doctors probably does, doctors and nurses and the teams we work in. So we've got that expertise. But because we're working with people who know that their disease is advanced, the other thing that I think is peculiar to us is that we're quite comfortable in having those conversations that are about what might be going to happen.
Okay, we'll get into that in a minute. But when I read your book, I was texting you to it. Actually, it's such a wonderful thing that you're here, because it was one of our listeners who said, you should be talking to Catherine Mannix about death. Because I've talked about death a bit on my podcast.
Yeah.
And I started reading your book, and I've never cried reading a book in my life. I've got tears pouring down my cheeks reading it. And I was like, I'm not sure I want to read this. This is horrific. There's a lot of people dying. And then when you start reading through it, it turns from being horrific to, it's actually quite a beautiful thing. And it's become quite an important book, I think, in my life. Very life-changing for me. My brother died of cancer. I watched him die. And I always sort of said, I'm not really sure I wanted to watch him die. And you made me feel like it was good that I was there at the end watching my brother die. So, it's an important book, but very, very hard to start.
Yeah.
But then tough to put down once you start.
Isn't that fascinating?
Why did you write it?
I wrote it because 30 years after I'd started working in palliative care, realising that nobody knew anything about dying, everybody was absolutely terrified of what they thought dying was like. What they thought dying was like was nothing like what dying is like. And at the beginning of my palliative care career, I thought, you know, in 30 years' time, we'll have educated people and I'll be meeting people who know more and they won't be so afraid and this will all be just so much easier. And that just wasn't happening.
Mm.
And I've spent the last 10 years of my clinical practice in a big, busy inner city teaching hospital. And one day I got called to the emergency room, and there was an elderly patient on a stretcher who'd come in with the paramedics had been doing chest compressions on the way into hospital. And there was one son weeping beside this unconscious patient, and then the wife and another couple of brothers arrived. And I'd seen this scenario so many times, but this one was the one that kind of said to me, it's time to do something now. The patient was in his 90s. He had things wrong with so many bits of him that, I think his liver worked fine, kind of thing, but his heart wasn't good, and his lungs were a bit knackered, and his kidneys weren't working, and bits of his nervous system weren't right anymore. And he'd been what we would call, in my neck of the woods, a creaking gait for right. years. And I said to his astonished children, his astonished sons, if your dad ever got so sick that he could die, what did he say he would want? And they said, we never talked about it.
Mm.
And then one of them said, actually, do you know what? Dad did try to talk to me about this. And I said, Dad, man, don't be so maudlin. You know, you're going to live forever. There's no need to worry about that kind of thing. And this son is in his 70s, started crying. And then his brother stepped forward and kind of stuck his hand on his weeping brother's arm to try and console him. And said, actually, it wasn't just you. Dad asked me if I'd make one of those attorney documents with him.
That story's in the book, isn't it?
There's a very similar story in the book. And actually, at that point, I just thought, we can't keep doing this one family at a time.
Yeah.
By the time we finish this conversation, we'll have another family who understands what normal dying is going to be like and what the process is that we're going to be supporting them through. But this is like the starfish on the beach story, isn't it? So you know the story.
No.
So there's an old man looking down the beach, and he can see a young boy, and the young boy keeps bending down and then standing up and flinging his arms, and he looks as though he's dancing. The old man goes down to see what's happening, and the little boy is picking up stranded starfish and he's throwing them back into the water. He says, what are you doing? And the little boy says, well, all these starfish, they're going to die if we don't get them back into the water. And the old man says, well, look at this beach. There are thousands of stranded starfish. Nothing you can do will make a difference. And the little boy smiles at him and he picks up another starfish and he flings it back in the ocean and says, well, I made a difference to that one.
Mm.
Now, in palliative care at the moment, we're meeting families one family at a time. We're making a difference to that one. But everybody's going to die.
Well, yeah, what is the death rate at the moment?
It's still running at roughly 100%. So, you know, and in the new NHS plan, we're going to reduce deaths by 500,000 a year, which is quite interesting because the death rate in England and Wales is about 520,000 deaths a year.
Is it?
So I want to be one of the 20,000 that isn't immortal, actually, right. You know. So there I was in casualty with this family and just thinking, somebody's got to do something about the public understanding of dying. I kind of wandered around the hospital for the next few weeks just thinking, somebody's got to do something about, somebody.
Mm.
And gradually, I think it just dawned on me that nobody was going to step up.
Well,
and maybe I could.
Well, this book is powerful stuff, honestly. It's really changed the way I see it all. One of the interesting things you talk about in it is the fact that modern medicine has been one of the factors why we don't like talking about death, or no, why we don't want to die. In the middle of the 20th century, you say we suddenly can start curing cancers, heart disease, and things like that. And so it's put even more pressure. So, like, you know, our 99-year-old granddad, heal him, make him live, him live. Because you go to hospital now with cancer, you don't die. You go, let's try and heal you. That's the case, is it?
Well, over the 20th century, we inaugurated the NHS, so you could go to hospital and it didn't bankrupt you.
Yeah.
And then all of these innovations started to come along. Some very simple antibiotics we just take for granted now, but they were novel. And what started to happen was people who were in the prime of life but struck down by something which in those days could have killed them Now we're taken to the hospital and one of these new wonder drugs was given, or there were better anaesthetics so you could do more complicated operations, or we had dialysis machines and you know, all sorts of new technologies. And it was absolutely fantastic that young, fit people, stricken down in their prime, no longer were obliged to die. That they could come back to being well, that they could get back into the workforce, that they could get back into their roles in their families. So I'm not decrying the miracle of modern medicine. It is fantastic what we've got and what we can do. The difficulty is that by changing what we could do, we change the experience of everybody about what happens when somebody's really sick. So my Nana was born in 1900. She was always the same age as the year.
Right.
And women's life expectancy in Britain, the year that she was born, at birth, on average, a woman would live to be age 58. And over her lifetime, she was 48 in 1948 when the NHS began. Over her lifetime, medicine was transformed. So as a young woman, she was the last generation to see her parents and her siblings die at home because there was nothing else that could be done. And her parents would have died in their 40s and 50s because that was the lifetime's average. Her children didn't see her die until she was nearly 97.
Mm.
Which means that my parents and my generation haven't seen what my grandmother's generation saw, which is what the process of dying is like. We've forgotten.
We've moved so far away from it. Mm. I'm just going to get your book here because there's a really good bit in here all about it, where you start talking about the process of dying is recognisable. There are clear stages you go into, say. In generations of humanity, before dying was hijacked by hospitals, the process was common knowledge. This is what you talk about here. And then it's funny because you then go on to say about births and deaths happened at home. They've both been basically, to want of a better word, hijacked by the hospitals. Mm-hmm. We now do it all in the hospitals. And so people, you say in here that there used to be the sort of a wise woman who would know about death in the society, would come to your house, which is probably your role now, is it? But all these things went.
Mm. Yeah.
So now we don't see death. I mean, I was lucky enough to see I feel lucky enough after reading about it. I was lucky enough to see my brother, but it was only through, he was taken to the hospital.
Yeah.
And I rushed up there and I got to see him take his last breath. But it's a lot of times you just put them in the hospital and that's it. That's what's happening.
Well, I think families try to get there. But I think one of the real dilemmas we've got is that when we train doctors and nurses in particular, we train them to stop people from dying. That's the job we're setting them up to do, really. It's not just about preserving wellness, enhancing wellness, it's about stopping death. And so in hospital, there are fewer practitioners who are familiar with that normal sequence of the process of dying that takes place when you're not trying to interfere with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so because of that, there isn't anybody who's in a position to be able to have that conversation that's the equivalent of the conversation a midwife has when she first meets a pregnant woman and whoever her birth partner is going to be, where she starts to describe to them exactly what it is that they should prepare for on Labour Day. So the whole of pregnancy is about getting to Labour Day with a healthy mum and a healthy baby and then getting that baby out with both parties remaining safe and well.
Yeah, you do your birth plan and everything, don't you?
Okay.
How do you want? Yeah.
So you make your plan, you make your plan B. Mm-hmm. Midwife might laugh behind her hand at both of those plans, but you still think you're going to get your plan. But the other thing that's really important is that she talks to you about how it will feel at the time that it's happening, and that you think you know what I mean now, but actually when it's really happening, I'll have to explain this again. Mm. And that's absolutely what happens, where she's then saying, you know, we talked about contractions, well, this is that. And, you know, we talked about feeling pressure down in your bottom. Well, this is that. And remember we talked about breathing? Well, just pant now. Mm. Yeah, no, don't push. Just pant. I'll tell you when to push. And because you've rehearsed it, there's this sense of safety and familiarity, even though at the same time it is, if it's your first baby, completely new and completely terrifying.
So midwives are obviously thought of as great people in our community, and they always talk about how wonderful their lives are. Mm-hmm. Do you have a similar feeling dealing with people on their deathbeds?
I think it's been an enormous privilege.
Right.
I've had the best career.
But do you spend a lot of time crying? Is there? I mean, whenever I talk, when I'm talking about interviewing you, often people are saying that, oh God, it's going to be terrible, how depressing, how miserable. That's everyone's attitude towards dying. But it doesn't feel like that to you, does it? But you must spend a lot of time crying. And
Do I spend a lot of time crying? I do drip a bit. It's true. I can give it back to you. When you're reading the stories and you cry, because I've had lots and lots of feedback from readers about crying reading this book, my sense is that it isn't only sadness that's making us cry. There's something about the sense of how bloody magnificent people are, how amazing human beings are, and how generous they are to each other at a time that is like no other in their concern for each other. And I think that moves us to tears. I don't think we're just howling with sadness and rage, are we?
No. I think the biggest thing you say is, this is the bit which in the book made me think most about it. Life will never be the same again. That is what bereavement, that everyone's trying to deal with it. When I'm reading the stories, I'm like, oh no, the mum's going to die, or the wife's dying, or the husband's dying, and it's life. Their life is never going to be the same again. Mm-hmm. And you absolutely nailed it there. I thought with that, that's what you're suffering with. Just looking at that change, and trying to just think those poor people won't ever see their mum again, and that's what really got to me. I don't know.
But that's because you've been there, and that's because you understand it, and I think one of the things that was really important to me, something I felt really passionate about in writing of this book, is there's a bit of me that is a person who has loved people who are now dead and who is bereaved for those people. So it isn't that I haven't had that personal experience. But I've also had this professional experience of working alongside dying people. Thousands and thousands of dying people. To be able to sit back and see the patterns, to be able to recognize that when people know what to expect, they feel just so much less afraid. And once they're no longer using all of their energy to manage their fear, they've got energy to do really important things like talk and laugh and drink tea and love people and those really important things, which are much, much more important than being afraid. So I think the more we know about it, the more we realise how gentle the process is, the less we will fear the process itself. But there's nothing I can say that won't make bereavement horrible.
Yeah, definitely fear is not knowing, lack of knowledge of something, definitely is what fear is about. Okay, so could you explain what happens then when someone is dying? You do quite a lot of examples in your book. Explain the sort of process people go through.
Okay, so I'm going to explain it, I think, the way I first heard it explained, because I'd been working as a junior doctor for 4 years. I'd worked in places with very sick people. I'd seen a lot of deaths by the time I decided to move out of oncology and into what was called hospice care, because the term palliative care hadn't been invented then.
Right.
So I thought I knew a bit, you know. And then we were looking after an absolutely wonderful, wonderful lady whose story is in this book. A French woman who was clearly one of the bravest people you could ever wish to meet. She'd been a member of the French Resistance during the Second World War. She'd sheltered a British airman who'd parachuted in and helped them to build radios, subsequently had fallen in love with him, married him, come to live in Britain. And he died about 10 years before he'd had a heart attack and died over the next couple of days. And she now started to be very anxious about what dying would be like. And her experience of watching people die had been seeing her husband die after his heart attack. And he'd been in and out of consciousness, but very brave. And they'd been very devout Catholics, and he'd said all the prayers and everything. Or seeing people shot. She hadn't seen other types of dying. And she was very frightened that if her pain got overwhelming, she would in some way disgrace herself before God in her beliefs. She would despair and end up separated for eternity from her husband. And that's a really, really huge existential belief to have to deal with. And she fessed up this fear of her pain overwhelming her and giving her despair to one of the nurses. And the nurse came and told the consultant who was running this hospice. And he said, oh, come with me, let's go and talk to her. So I thought I was going to go and do a pain management talk. But when he sat down, he said to her, I hear you're worried about what dying is going to be like. And she said, oui. And I thought, that's not really very subtle, is it? That's a bit in your face. He said, I wondered whether it would be helpful for you if we talk about what to expect as you're dying. And she nodded, and I thought, this is really uncomfortable. This is really weird. So I'm sitting on one of those little stools that patients put their feet on. And he's sitting on the bed, and she's chatting to him. And he explained to her that as we approach the ends of our lives, it doesn't seem to matter what the illness is that we're dying from. These illnesses eventually all do something through some kind of final common pathway that just takes away our energy. And so as we become more poorly, we need more sleep, and it's sleep that recharges the energy batteries. And he said to her, have you noticed that already? And she said, yes. So he said, well, good, that means you're following the normal pattern then. So I'll tell you a bit more of the normal pattern, and I'll stop if you want me to stop at any point. And she agreed. So he said, as time goes by, what we notice is that people sleep more and they're awake less. But they're still their normal self when they're awake and they enjoy chatting. And then an interesting change happens where somebody will look as though they're asleep, but maybe it's medicine time or maybe there's an important visitor. And we try to wake them up and we can't waken them. They're not just asleep. They're actually unconscious. They're in a coma. And then when they waken, they say they've had a nice sleep. So we don't notice these periods of unconsciousness. But we know now that your pain or your breathlessness or your itch, whatever your symptoms might be, might come back while you're dipping into unconsciousness. And we don't want those symptoms to be there in all their force when you wake up again. So we'll swap the way we give you medicines now. We'll give them as injections, or we'll put them into a little syringe pump. So time goes by and people are sleeping more. They're awake less. They're dipping in and out of unconsciousness until the time comes when the person is just unconscious all of the time. Now, when we're deeply unconscious, the only bit of our brain that's we really know is still working is the breathing center deep in the brainstem at the back of our brain. And once we're not thinking about managing our breathing anymore, which we don't think about, except you are subconsciously not making breathing noises next to your microphone. And I'm controlling the way I'm breathing in order to be able to speak in sensible phrases. Once our brain is switched off to the point that it's just automatic breathing, then it's cycles of breathing that go between very deep and quite snory sounding sometimes. And if you didn't know better, you could think that person was groaning.
Right.
And then shallow and panting sounding breathing. And if you didn't know better, you could think that that person was breathless. And so explaining in advance, like a midwife does before a labour, is one of those gifts that you can then bring into the room later to say, remember we talked about the breathing. Well, this is that breathing.
What about the heart rate? Does that go, does that change?
So that's an interesting thing. So in normal human dying, the heart stops last. So after the breathing
but
has stopped.
But does it go through strange little cycles and stuff?
So it depends sometimes on the illness that somebody's had, and it depends on other things like if we're hot, our pulse goes up. If we're uncomfortable, our pulse goes up. So we use the pulse to tell us whether or not this person who's no longer speaking to us is having runs of very fast heart rate that might suggest that they're not completely unconscious and they're a bit uncomfortable. And because we know them well, we know that, you know, this person, when they get uncomfortable, it's because of nausea, and we'll give them their nausea drug, or it's pain and we'll give them their pain drug. There are other things that happen as well. So you start to notice that blood pressure starts to drop, which means that the skin doesn't get as much blood supply. So the body starts to cool down. And palliative care nurses talk about people getting cold knees, that their knees get cold even though they've got blankets over them. The face starts to relax and it starts to look a little bit flat, a little bit not its normal shape because it's so deeply relaxed. If you really relax your face, your mouth might just be open just because your muscles are so relaxed. So following those changes is an important part of what's going on. And at the very end of somebody's life, the thing that happens is during one of those phases of shallow, very gentle breathing, there will be an out-breath that just doesn't have an in-breath after it. That's it.
So people always die with an out-breath?
I've had a really interesting letter from somebody who said their dad died after an in-breath, and actually it turned out that he had one of those lung diseases where he'd lost the elasticity of his lungs.
Right.
And those people have to work to breathe out. But for most of us, we work to breathe in and then we relax and breathe out.
Do you think people enjoy dying? Do you think it's a nice experience?
What a really great question. It seems to me that it's a sad experience because just as we're anticipating a loss of being with that person when we love them, they're anticipating that loss from their end too. But in terms of a physical discomfort experience, it looks like a relaxing experience. And there are lots of people who report this strange facial expression that some, but not all people have at the very end of their lives, of looking very relaxed, looking very pleased about something.
Reading your book made me think, okay, I can look forward to death because it's got to happen to me. As someone told me once, there's this old Chinese sort of insult is, I wish you good a long life. I wish you a good life means, I hope you're, you know, I like you, hope you have a good life. I wish you a long life. Means I don't like you. Yes. I wish you eternity in your horrible life, basically. Because a lot of cultures believe dying is a lovely thing. That's what happens to you, and you want to do that. Whereas we're so terrified of it. And the interesting thing in your book as well, and I've really noticed this since I've been reading your book, is the language we use. So we say lost, we say passed away, and we say lost their battle with death. And the other thing we do is, the one that's really struck me, because there's so many people obviously dying all the time, and famous people, celebrities, and they talk about it, and everyone goes, what really sad news that someone age 88 or something has died. I'm like, sad at 88? Mm-hmm. We've all got to die. 88's not a bad...
Yeah.
It's not sad, is it? Is it sad that someone passed away at 88? I think that's where we all get terrified because of that.
Yeah, so we're sad. We've liked that person.
Yeah.
We're sad that we're not going to see them and hear them anymore. It may be a person that we're very close to and that we've loved, or it may be, you know, a celebrity who's died and we've admired them and, you know, we're not going to hear them crack new jokes anymore or make new songs anymore or whatever it is. So the sadness is ours, isn't it? It's not actually the news that's
okay,
sad.
So it's not sad news, it's we feel sad.
Yeah, I think so.
And we feel sad, I get back to life will never be the same again.
Yeah.
That's why we're sad, isn't it?
It is. And that yearning part of bereavement is really, really tough. But the other part of the pattern that we can recognise when we see it often enough is that bereavement itself is a process. And you will know this. So the emotions that you feel in those first days, weeks, months, years of the loss of somebody who is singularly precious to you, they are hard, strong emotions, and they almost bowl us over. It is almost as though that is all there is left of us, is that sense of loss. And yet, as time goes by, we carry on having life experiences and we keep adding more things. And I saw a really lovely diagram of bereavement just this week, where somebody kind of drew a circle of the person's life and then coloured the whole thing in as it got filled with the grief of a bereavement. And that the old theory was that over time, that grief somehow got less. And what this person was saying was, actually, it's probably not that the grief gets less. It's that our being gets bigger around it. That there is something about carrying on living, processing the bereavement, being grateful for the relationship that we had, even though we regret the loss of it in bereavement, that enables us to grow, and that we're bigger around it.
It's such a weird feeling when someone dies. You know, to go back to my brother, the experience. It's just this waking up every day going, I want to stop thinking, because that's all I can think about. Yes. From the minute you wake up to the moment you go to bed. It's just this constant, you know, just think. Yeah. Why did this happen? It's horrible. And, you know,
yeah.
That's why I think it might be nice if we got to an age where people are in their 80s and 90s and we weren't so sad about it. We were used to it. I think that's why this book is important, that we can get back to expecting death and finding some, sounds such a bizarre thing to say, but some joy in the fact that they've had a nice, long life.
Yeah. And one of the things that's really lovely in palliative care, why are we not all sad and weird? Because I think we're not sad and weird. is that we see that kind of joy that's happening in families. Yeah. Once they've got to the point of saying, okay, so there's no point in wrestling with this tiger anymore. It is going to happen. So what's important now? And then the other set of patterns that we start to see, that again I've written about in the book, that over and over again what happens next is that people want to celebrate what they mean to each other. They're so grateful for what they have had in their lives. They want to say thank you. They want to repair relationships. Usually, occasionally there are people who still want to carry on causing damage and havoc for people that they've had some really catastrophic falling out with. But most people want reconciliation. And more than anything else, they want to tell people that they love them. And what's really great is we're so embarrassed in Britain about love.
Mm-hmm.
The L word is nearly as difficult as the D words, you know, in terms of people being able to say it aloud. But there seems to be something very freeing about thinking you haven't got very much life left, so you need to get on and say this stuff. So love becomes a much more kind of spoken transaction amongst people rather than just an assumption. And people go to huge lengths to make contact with people. People come and visit from far away. And I think it's the closest we can get to the more traditional societies, and this still happens on the west coast of Ireland, where once you know your neighbour's dying, you pop round to say goodbye and thank you.
So do you think the truth and the honesty of actually discussing death actually becomes a beautiful thing for everybody involved in it, so they can actually say goodbye properly?
Yeah, I do.
And do you think we're suffering with that a lot then?
I think that our bereavements would be less awful if we didn't have it. I wish I'd said,
right.
I wonder if she knew. And one of the examples I use of this quite a lot is, do you remember, I'm sure you remember, when those planes went into the Twin Towers, people phoned home. And it was before we had all these fancy mobile phones. They were using desk phones in the building. And it was during the working day, so they were getting the answer phone tapes when they phoned home. They weren't getting their families. And they played those messages. And those messages were, I love you. Don't forget, I love you. Those people knew they were not going to get out. And they weren't phoning people to scream and say, this is terrible. They were phoning to say, I am not going to see you again.
Yeah.
And I want you to know how much I love you.
When you tell someone they're dying, is there stages they go through too? Is there a stage of denial? Is there any panic which sets in? Are there things like that?
Okay. It's quite unusual to be in a position where you're telling somebody that they're going to die and they've got no idea.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So usually what is happening is that I'm answering their questions.
Okay.
And they creep towards, so what's the bottom line then? And one of the questions that I'll use, because I think that actually it's much easier for people to feel that they're safe if you ask questions and ask them to answer first and then play with their answer with them rather than just going in and being an expert and telling them stuff.
Yeah.
So I would say to people something like, it sounds like you're thinking a lot about this illness and what it means for you. Have you got a kind of best hope, and have you got a worst dread? And would it be helpful for you for us to talk about those things? And I usually try and do worst dread first, because best hope is the rescue strategy, if you like, of how can we make what's unfolding here be as close to your best hope as it can be.
But surely this conversation is completely different if it's a 80-year-old in comparison to a 30-year-old.
It's sometimes surprising how much the 80-year-old wants to cling to life. And it's sometimes surprising what wisdom and maturity there is in somebody in their 30s. So I think in palliative care, we would take everybody just as the individual that they are.
But death is always harder, isn't it? If it's a child, you're leaving, you know, parents don't want to be outliving their children. Mm. And it's a harder way around, isn't it?
It is a harder way around. Mm. And there is no doubt about that. And I haven't set out in this book to sugar the pill.
No.
All I've set out to do is say, look, guys, dying is a process that we can recognise and manage. And the more we know about it, the less there is to fear about the process of it. But that sense of separation, it's always going to be very sad.
And it also must be really bad when it's really hard, sorry, if the person who's dying is suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's and they don't really know their family anymore.
So one of the problems that we've got, that we've landed ourselves in with modern medicine, is we're so good at stopping people from dying in their youth and prime that we're adding decades to our lives.
Mm.
But we're not getting another couple of decades in our 30s and 40s. You know, the reward is that we get our 80s and 90s and even our 100s. So we've got to ask ourselves, I think, some really difficult questions as a society about, is that actually really what we want? So we've got lots of preventative care strategies go on. So GPs are checking our blood pressure and assessing our heart disease risk and looking at our, you know, lipids in our blood. Mm. And then we'll take drugs to control this and drugs to control that to stop you having a heart attack, stop you having a stroke, keep your blood vessels squeaky clean. And, you know, while we're young and fit, those are really worthwhile things. But I do start to wonder whether there isn't a case for naming a birthday at which you'll stop taking all those long-term preventing things. Because do I want to get into my late 90s, not recognise my children, not be able to look after myself, not be able to go to the toilet on my own? Or would I rather have a nice big stroke sometime in my late 70s when I'm still regularly going out running?
Though that brings us nicely on to, by the way, just very quickly, I didn't really get your take on the language. You want us to say death and dying.
I do.
You don't want us to say passed away and lost and battle.
Yeah, don't make me come over there and sort you out with the battle language. You know, that is just, I think that bereaved people and sick people, they have permission to use whatever language gets them through. So what we need to not be is the thought police or the language police. But something that I increasingly see happening is that you are a recently bereaved person, say your brother had recently died.
Yeah.
and I say to you, Tim, I'm really sorry to hear that your brother died. And then some other person who I don't know comes up to me and says, that was really insensitive of you to use the word died in front of Tim when his brother's just died. When actually, in our transaction, it was absolutely fine.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of set of thought police out there, language police out there, who are telling us that it's insensitive to use the actual words. But if we don't use the words, we can't talk to each other about the process.
I found that when my brother died, that if anyone discussed cancer around me, they go, oh, sorry, Tim. I'm yeah. like, well, hold on, my brother's, you know, he's gone. He's dead. He died of cancer. Doesn't mean we can't talk about cancer anymore. No. But people are so terrified of upsetting people.
Yeah.
And I think that's done from a good place, though.
I'm sure it is.
But then it adds to the fear. Helping. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. But we're just going back to long life and what we need to do with it. And you talk a bit about euthanasia in the book. And I find it fascinating, actually, because I've always been probably on the side of, yeah, it's really good if you want to take your own life, you should be able to. It's your life, do whatever. But you make the point in your book that the sides get very vocal about it, don't they? Mm. Both sides of this discussion. And yet it's much more complex than that.
Yeah.
What are your views on it?
So my views on it are that it's something much more complex than that. And that I haven't written a book about euthanasia. But I have written a book that invites us to start to talk about it in the real place where the discussion needs to happen, which is here in this middle grey place of difficult, nuanced thinking. And one of the difficulties that we've got is that the poles of the debate are extremely vociferous, but they are people who have formed their opinion usually in a crucible of some horrible personal experience. So they're speaking from passion and they're often speaking from hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really hard to have a conversation from the centre ground with people on either side of the discussion when their passion is fueled by grief and sadness. So what I'm trying to do is distill some of the wisdom from having looked after thousands and thousands of people at the ends of their lives. So rather than me talking about what I wish could have happened to my best friend when she was dying in her 50s of cancer, or what I wish could have happened to my beloved uncle when he was dying in his 90s with Alzheimer's disease, I'm talking about the human condition
mm-hmm.
as a whole. And I think it's a debate we need to have. I think it's really interesting when you watch the Houses of Parliament talking about this, because we've had 3 debates now in the last decade, 2 in the House of Lords and 1 in the House of Commons, on whether or not to change the law to assist with dying. And the usual baying and heckling of the House of Commons was completely, completely abandoned. People listened with deep respect to each other. And I think that's how we need to have this conversation.
Yeah, just to give a bit of background, in your book you talk about a guy who was in Holland, a British guy who'd got a terrible illness, and because they've got euthanasia over there. Or what do they call it? Assisted suicide? I don't know what they call it.
They call it euthanasia in the Netherlands.
Netherlands. And they kept, doctors kept saying to him, you know, you can choose to end your life. And it happened to him so frequently. He got fed up with it because he had children and he wanted to just to spend the rest of his... He wanted to live his life as long as possible, didn't he, to be with his family and children, his young children. So he came back to Britain in the end. So he got stopped asking whether he wanted to end his own life. And so I never thought about it like that. But
yeah, and I hadn't either, of course, because we don't have an assisted dying law in Britain.
Mm.
Those of us who are working in palliative and end-of-life care, we haven't got experience of working within a law like that to report on. If we change the law, then somebody can write about that when they've had a bit of experience from it. But I was quite startled by that experience. And the thing that was interesting for me was that the patient himself was quite a pragmatist. He quite admired the Dutch sense of personal choice, and you know, he thought that that was a good law. So it wasn't that he was an ideological objector. What he found was that in practice, it changed how safe he felt when he was much more vulnerable and thinking differently from the way that we think when we're healthy. So that's one of the things that we have to ask our legislators to think about, that actually, if you're well enough to be sitting in the Houses of Parliament, you probably are not somebody who's had the life experience of that degree of vulnerability. And so one of the interesting lobbies in the Houses is from people who have physical disabilities, who lobby largely against changing the law because they fear that in some way they are made more vulnerable if the law is changed. So I've tried not to take sides at all in the book.
No,
so,
you haven't at all.
And so there's a story of somebody who's on a ventilator with motor neurone disease who wants to discontinue ventilation. That's exactly the position that Noel Conway, who was campaigning for changing the law, found himself in. And this is a patient who, you know, could legitimately stop his ventilation and would not be able to breathe. Now, that would be horrible, wouldn't it? Because you would be awake, you'd be alert, and you'd be unable to breathe. So the question then was, is he allowed to stop his ventilator? Yes, he is. Of course he is. Are we allowed to stop him feeling breathless? Yes, of course we are, because we're managing the symptoms of his illness, which is an inability to breathe. So it's much, much more nuanced than the polls. And I want to invite people into a much, much richer discussion about what would be the advantages to people who currently fear living badly, because I think it's living badly more than dying badly that is a real problem. What would be the advantages if we changed the law? But also, everywhere that's changed the law has worked really, really hard to build in safeguards for vulnerable people, and the jury is out about how successful or not those things are. So who are the people who currently are advantaged by the law as it is now, who don't even know that they are? But once the law is changed, like that young guy who supported the law change in the Netherlands and then found himself in a position that he'd never anticipated being in. So I'm not going to be giving an opinion about whether I think it's a good thing or a bad thing to change the law, because I want to talk about dying in the round. I want people to think about dying in a much more whole way, the physical experience, the emotional experience, the family experience, and be more knowledgeable and then make up their minds.
It's such a bizarre thing, isn't it, that our lives have to come to an end? It's really bizarre.
Is it?
Well, it's been taken, I think through reading your book, it's been taken so far away from us. No one ever thinks about it. So it's just, I'm reading your book, it was like being smashed in the face with your book. You're going to die, Tim. honestly, you're going to die. And it's like, wow, I'm going to die. So you start thinking about it. And I've never really thought about it. And a lot of people will say, oh, just wait, you're old to think about it. But why can't I think about it every day? All the self-help books and stuff always tell you, you should think about death every day, because that means you can live. If you're thinking about death, you think, well, I'm going to die. And the great thing is, what happened with reading your book is you suddenly realise things are so irrelevant, because you visualise yourself on your deathbed. And, you know, everyone always makes the point, and it's so true. On your deathbed, and I'd like you to expand on this for me in a minute, I doubt you sit there and think, God, I once had a really lovely car. Or, oh, just remember that holiday. You think about relationships. Imagine that's all you really think about, is relationships with pets and humans. Yeah. And I think that's kind of it. And that's what life is about, really, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that your experience of having thousands of people, seeing thousands of people?
So what are people thinking about? They're thinking about their relationships. They are thinking about the people who they have loved who are already dead. People who have a faith in an afterlife are actually looking forward to seeing people again. Some of them get quite excited about that. That's really rather lovely. And other people who have no belief in an afterlife afterlife, who see oblivion as the kind of laying down of the burden. And then there are other people who are terrified of oblivion, and other people who are terrified of what God's going to say if he's there. So, you know, it's very, very individual. But back in the room, there is this thing about relationships and being with people and making the most of savouring every moment.
Do you think religion... Are you religious?
Again, it's a imponderable question, isn't it?
Do you think religion helps?
I think that... Well, I know that there are religious people who are immensely comforted
right.
by their faith. But there are other religious people who believe in a God who's vengeful, and they might not have been good enough. And it's almost like you're getting your exam results. Are you going to get to heaven or not?
Oh, God.
So one of the things that most palliative care services are pretty good at is knowing which clergy to call on for these troubled individuals
yeah.
who will come and bring them an interpretation of whatever their scripture is, whether it's, you know, the Quran or the Bible or whatever, that is about love and mercy rather than vengeance and anger. Because everybody's got the vengeance and anger stories in their individual scriptures. It's quite interesting how many similarities there are across the different holy books. So I think religion can be a force for real good, but it can be problematic as well.
Someone said to me once, a lot of people don't start living until they know they're dying. And what they meant by that was they start looking at things and going, wow. And they've been so caught up in our fake human world. Mm. Suddenly they realise none of it matters anymore because they know they're on their way out. They don't have to think about their mortgage or their bank balance or anything. And they just start looking around at nature and staring and going, wow, this is what it's like to be alive. Do you find that ever?
Yeah, yeah. So I see it a lot in patients and really tiny little details. One of the things that's lovely about palliative care patients is they notice details. So you go into the room, they say, what happened at your daughter's interview? I don't remember I told you about my daughter's interview, but they've remembered. So they're these kind of little beacons of kindness, because that's the stuff that really matters. And people love to see the changes in nature, for example. And one of the great comforts, almost an existential, a spiritual comfort, even to people who don't have a religion, is that sense of the circle of life, the cycle of nature. Looking out of the window and seeing that the leaves are starting to turn green, or they're starting to turn brown, and that, you know, life is carrying on, and that this will carry on even when I'm not here to see it anymore. So it's quite transcendent, this really interesting thing that happens to all of us, just ordinary people whose minds get expanded into this space of what's really important when you're not worrying about paying your rent or feeding the cat or whatever it is.
So that should be a lesson for the living?
Every time.
Do you say that to people?
That would sound really sanctimonious, wouldn't it?
I don't think it would. I think you could, you know, next thing you could be a self-help book. I think it's important to know what people are thinking on their deathbeds, because I think we waste a lot of our lives doing nonsense and worrying about, especially worrying me. Oh, God, I don't stop worrying. A friend of mine, Dave, started living in the woods for a while. He made some money. It was a good thing. It was like an experiment. Can I live without it? And I went to visit him in the woods, and I said to him, what did you notice most? He said, one day you look down and you see bluebells and you go, oh my God, look at the bluebells. And then they're there. And then you look around a week later and this nice beautiful thing in the world, and you look around a week later and they're dead or dying, and you go, where are they going? They're dead, they're dying. And you realise that, just you say that, the circle of life. And he said, just look around, where there's a dead tree, there's green stuff growing through. And he goes, it's just this amazing thing of life. It sounds very deep, but that kind of brings you back to nature, and that's, I suppose, where we end up on our deathbeds.
Yeah. And I think that's a real thing that a lot of us see in palliative care. And I like to think that perhaps that helps us as people who are not dying to be a little bit more grounded and to not sweat the small stuff. But actually,
if only we could.
If only.
How do you organise your appointments? I imagine you turn up for an appointment and say you give someone an hour slot. You can't. How can you put a time on an appointment? Do you just have to do one a day, or
you
what
just
happens?
Can't. So people just get used to you being late for everything. patients are fine about you being late because they know that you're late because the person before them needed the time that you gave them, and that they will get their time.
You can't go time up, can you?
You just really, really can't. And my, you know, my kids and my husband very, very long suffering about it over the years. I ran a cognitive therapy outpatient clinic in our local Marie Curie hospice.
Okay.
And that, I get people coming in and, you know, sit down, meet and greet, and say, so, you know, really lovely to see you. Sometimes there'd be people I'd met during my hospital palliative care visiting, where most of my consultation work was in a hospital, or sometimes there were people who'd been referred in by GPs or palliative care nurses, whatever. So here's my clinic, nice to meet you. What are you hoping we might be able to help you with? And they would pull this piece of paper out of the bag with a trembling hand, and they'd point to the top where it says Marie Curie Hospice. And you're, oh, yeah, yeah. Were you a bit surprised to get an appointment for a hospice? And you have this conversation then about, yeah, hospices, you don't come for an outpatient appointment, do you? You come in, lie in a bed and go out in a box. And actually helping people to see that there's a whole set of stuff happening in palliative care that is just in the now, and some of it is daycare and some of it is outpatients, and you know, if you're not well enough to come to some of these appointments, I might have to come and see you at home. Let me know if I need to bring tea bags because I'm a big tea consumer. It's really, really important you know this about me. And just being able to relate to people where they are. So those were 1 hour appointments, and I was very much better at managing those. But even then, you know, 2 minutes before the end of the appointment, you'd have somebody say, it's probably been coming up and they've been pushing it down all the way through. I'm really, really worried about what dying's going to be like. And you just think, oh, here's another day that I'm not going to pick my kids up from school. Because actually, I can't just leave that there.
Well, I've got to say, the Macmillan nurse who came round to, or the Macmillan nurses who came round to see us when my brother was dying, just really changed everything. I mean, amazing people.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just for my brother, who, you know, my brother was young, so he had a bit of panic and he felt lonely and he felt all these sort of feelings and stuff and didn't know what was happening to him. But also for my parents and me to say, this is what's happening. This is what's happening with your brother at the moment. And it's the job they do is phenomenal, because as you say, we are so removed from death now. And it's not a good thing. After reading your book, I realised that it's not a good thing we've become so removed from it, because it's, as we mentioned, keep on mentioning, it's 100% death rate still. Mm-hmm. So this is going to happen to us. We need to talk about it more. They're amazing people, and I try and do as much as I can for them, because I just think that's the important part of it. I also do a lot of work with Teenage Cancer Trust as well, and that's really hard when you see the young people. It always seems to me that we mentioned it a little bit earlier, death in young people seems to be the hardest thing, because they don't seem to have had the life.
Yeah, it seems much more unfair, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I took on doing palliative care consultations for our local children's cancer service in the hospital, just for a few months while they were looking into funding a palliative paediatrician. And those few months turned into 16 years of consultations. And gosh, young people are absolutely amazing, because they do that wisdom thing and they're still so young.
What do you mean, the wisdom thing?
So they do that thing of there's only now. When you look at the great wisdom figures through history, they all say something very, very similar.
Live in the now.
And they say it's now. Mm. Here it is. It is now. And those kids, they get to that. So one of the stories is one of those young people making a souvenir for her mum to be able to remember her by, like her mum might need
that one again. That'll a get souvenir. That'll get me going again, that one. That broke my heart, reading that one.
And she was just an absolutely amazing person, because it was all about everybody else. It was all about, how is my mum going to be? And how is my dad going to be? I saw a really lovely young woman in my cognitive therapy clinic who was having anxiety attacks. And she actually used to refer to me as to her oncologist. She used to say, I'm going to go and see Dr. Panics. And we would do cognitive therapy for panic attacks. She was an absolutely fantastic person. But she was really good at unpacking what her anxiety is. You know, when you feel really anxious about something, what you think you want to do is not think about it. Mm-hmm. So you try really hard to not think about it. And as soon as I ask you not to think about something, it's the only thing you can possibly think about. And I think that thing you said about bereavement before is an example of this. I don't want to think about this because it hurts me so much. So I don't want to. And it keeps coming back. And the trick that she had to learn was to allow that thought to just be there and swim past her like a fish in a bowl, and then see what the next thought was that followed it, because the next thought could never follow while she was still holding that one back.
I just felt like I was in a horror movie all the time. And since then, I don't watch horror movies. I don't watch anything which disturbs me too much because I just think, oh, I've been through that. I don't want to do it again.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And
what the hell do I want to watch that for?
I can't watch sad movies for entertainment. No. I don't read sad books.
No.
You know, if you're doing it for a living, why on earth would you do it for entertainment as well?
I don't know.
But that's an important thing that you're saying.
Why do we put ourselves through that as humans? Do you think we're getting ourselves ready for it?
Well, I think we're taunting ourselves a little bit, aren't we?
I don't know.
And don't we love death as entertainment?
Yeah.
So tragedies, murders, zombie movies.
I remember just after my brother died, I watched it was called something like Million Dollar Baby. I don't know, it was a boxing film. And the, And the woman at the end of it, I'm sorry if anyone's spoiler alert, by the way, it's just 13 years ago or something, but the woman at the end of it, she gets killed. And I was like going... did she die or she get put in a coma or I can't remember. And I'm like, I don't want to watch this. I've just witnessed my brother. And I just turned it off then and there. That's why I don't know whether she died or not. I was watching it on the
That's the worst complaint we're ever going to have.
What?
That's the worst complaint we're ever going to have. Spoiling the film.
Spoiling the film. And I just turned it off immediately. I went, I don't want to watch this. This is horrific. Mm. And then since then, I always say, people say, do you want to watch this movie? Or do you want to see this? I say, well, is it sad or nice? And it's like, if it's too sad, I'm not watching it. Because I just can't be bothered
to go through that emotion again. I'm absolutely with you. We can get the cinema. It'd be fine.
You've done it a million times.
Mm.
What advice would you have for people who are going through bereavement? What advice would you have for someone who's going through a bereavement? Let's start with that one.
Okay, so I have to say I'm not really a bereavement expert.
Right.
Because I see people into their bereavement.
Yeah.
And then I meet them afterwards.
Okay, but the bit going into the bereavement...
So I would say...
is helpful.
So going into your bereavement, first of all those lovely things about that person that you loved who has died are still absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to forget them. You're not going to forget those things. And that last vision of them that you have lying on their deathbed might seem like the only memory you can find at the moment, but it won't be the only memory you can find. You've still got that whole photograph album of your lives together in your head, and all of those other lovely memories, they will come back. So don't be frightened of going to, perhaps you've missed seeing somebody as they've died and you don't know whether to go and see them dead or not. The research evidence suggests that seeing somebody safely dead is quite a helpful part of then getting into the healthy process of bereavement, because bereavement is our adjustment process for not getting taken down by somebody else's death. So if you're worried about going to see them, go with somebody you trust. But unless you feel really strongly not to, then go on in and say goodbye.
And should you be, if you're close to the person who's dying, should you try and always be at the death of the person?
I think that is partly up to the person who's dying. Maybe that's a question to ask them earlier on. So there's a story in the book of a young lad who's dying, who can't bear the idea of how distressing it will be for him to be dying with his mum sitting beside the bed, knowing that it's his dying that's causing her to be distressed. And knowing that she knows that he's distressed by her distress, So she's trying not to look distressed in order not to distress him. And he and I had a conversation that ended up being hysterically funny about that tragic paradox. And he was very, very funny. But he was able to say, actually, Mum, when the day comes, I want a big cuddle. I want to say goodbye. And then you have to go out the room. Let Dad be in here. But I just can't bear to watch you.
Mm. Because my friend said that he used to work at hospice quite a long time ago, and he said that often when, and you mentioned in your book, often when relatives go for a cup of tea or something, they leave the room, the patient dies.
Yeah, more often than can possibly be by chance. So often that actually we explain to families that this is the thing that happens, and we don't know why. So it happens in two directions. So there's the person who is so sick that they should have been dead weeks ago.
Yeah.
And nobody knows why they are still here, but they are. And then the phone call comes from Australia that says the grandchild has been safely born, or the long lost nephew from Canada arrives. The person can be deeply unconscious. It's just that the voice of the person is in the room, because it seems that hearing is one of those things that's still preserved even when we're unconscious.
Yeah.
And it's almost like people are waiting for a particular thing to happen so that they can die.
Yeah.
It's quite rare for people to die on Christmas Day, but we have a bit of a mass die-in in the few days after Christmas.
Oh, right.
In 1999, in the millennium Christmas New Year, we didn't have the post-Christmas die-in in the hospice where I was working. The buggers all hung on until they got into the year 2000.
Really?
It was so interesting.
Wow.
But what's that about? We don't really know. And then there's this other thing of a family that have been in constant attendance around somebody in their bedroom, or the bed's downstairs in the living room, or they're around the bed in the hospital or the hospice, and they've got rotors and all the rest of it. And then there's this 1 30-second period when somebody's popped out to take a phone call and somebody else has gone to the loo, and the person stops breathing while they're not in the room.
Feels it's the right time.
And who knows what that is about?
So your big advice for people is, I'm guessing, be honest about the fact that someone's dying, so that the last days, hours, weeks, you can spend telling each other you love each other,
yeah,
and what you mean to each other.
Yeah, and be honest about that too, because actually,
so
it's
don't go into denial, because there's many examples in your book where people are going, they're not dying, or the person's going, I'm not dying. The denial thing is not a good thing. You should openly admit it, get it, and then enjoy the last days.
Well, yes, and so denial is a really, really good self-defense mechanism.
Oh, for the person who's dying.
Okay, and I don't think we can insist that the dying person obeys any rules at all.
I confuse that. Yeah, I mean for the people who are being left.
Yeah, but it must be very, very difficult if you are a dying person and you want to say goodbye to somebody who's very dear to you, and that person says, "No, don't talk like that. Keep fighting."
Yeah.
It's such a lonely place if you've got to be the person who's doing the dying, and you've also got to be in charge of the emotions of everybody else in the room.
Okay. All right.
So let's not do that to people. Let's try and find a way of having the conversations that they want to have, because this is the last chance for them to have those conversations.
Right.
And we've got the rest of our lives to sew ourselves back together again. And the actual truth is that if we accompany them with absolute integrity and respect for the way they want to do it, in our bereavement, we will be consoled by having done that. So even though it might feel really, really hard, it will help us afterwards to know that we did that effort out of our love for that person.
Great advice. Everyone who comes to my podcast asks the same questions too, so I'm going to ask you them as well. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Be here now.
Be here now.
Be here now. This is what counts. This is the moment.
Mm.
Turn up. And even when you don't feel like turning up, turn up.
What's the biggest mistake you've made?
I've really, really wrestled with this one.
Mm.
there's a thing I did as a young mum that I would do really differently now, which was that our daughter wanted to play with the big girls down the street. And she was little and in school and learning to read and learning to write. And the big girls were much bigger. And they said, oh, come and wait by the gate and we'll come out and get you. And then she heard them on the other side of the gate talking about how they weren't ever going to come out and get her. So she came home and she said, so she told me this story. And then she said, so come and see what I've done. So she took me down the street and she chalked on the pavement outside their house in best age 5½ or 6 year old writing, completely phonetically, you are mean and horrid girls and I don't want to be your friend. And what I should have done was be incredibly proud of her and tell her so.
Yeah.
And what I did was feel incredibly proud, but explain how we mustn't be mean to other people when they're mean to us. And it was a mistake. Actually, I should have just said, you are the best thing since sliced bread, because this is absolutely the right thing to say. In fact, if I could help you write it on a piece of paper, we could put it into a paper plane and throw it over the gate to them.
Are you big on honesty then?
I don't think we do ourselves any favours by pretending.
Have you ever read Sam Harris's book, Lying?
No.
I recommend it.
Okay.
Another book which has been really influential in my life, which is one which is never lie, just always tell people the truth. It doesn't mean you have to offer up the truth. But if someone asks you something, tell them the truth. I mean, your life is just a better place to be. And I just, it's intriguing. It's great. It's not a long book, but I read it once. My mate gave it to me years ago and I just had it sitting around. And one day I picked it up and read it and I was just like, wow, this is a way to live your life. Just tell everyone the truth.
Yeah.
It's really nice. If you don't want to go somewhere, I actually don't want to do it. And like, why? God, just doesn't suit me. I don't want to do it or something like that. And it's a really nice way of doing, going through life, just telling everyone the truth rather than making up stupid things and doing whatever
that's
else.
It's just beautifully assertive, isn't it? You know, I'm you're okay. I can tell you this because you're okay and I'm okay as well.
Exactly right.
Lovely. Mm. Yeah.
Which is interesting because it sort of ties into a lot of what you write in your book. Any life hacks?
Rubber gloves. Just a useful thing to have about your person. I don't know how guys manage without a handbag. I haven't actually got rubber gloves in my handbag at the moment. But I have arthritis in these joints here, and it makes it really difficult to open bottles and jar tops and things like that. So a pair of rubber gloves increases the friction, easy to just get the tops off things.
I've never owned a pair of rubber gloves in my life.
Right. Well, do you know...
What? Yeah, why would you own... Well, I've used my... I use my skin.
So, Tim, I bought you a present.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And I wish it was rubber gloves now.
What is it?
I bought you pasta.
Oh, thank you.
What do you do? You're visiting a chef. I would have brought you eggs.
I'm not a chef.
He's not a chef.
He's not a chef.
But I do work on a cooking show. That is true. But
I would have brought you eggs. But it's a long way from Northumberland with 6 eggs in your bag. I'm not that stupid. So it's pasta instead.
Okay. Can you recommend a book?
I can. I think everybody should read Oliver Sacks' very short book, Gratitude. So Oliver Sacks is... the medical writer's medical writer. Absolutely wonderful descriptions of the patients that he looked after as a neurologist through his career. And he's the guy who wrote the book Awakenings, that the film with Robin
Williams.
No. Yes. Was. Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that film.
So when Sacks found out that he was terminally ill in his early 80s, he wrote just 4 short essays on noticing the approach of the end of his life and how magnificent a thing it has been to be alive. You could read the book in a couple of hours, but it's transformational.
I think that is the most important thing I'm learning in recent, and your books helped me do it as well, in recent months, years, probably the last 6 months or so, is just nothing matters apart from just looking around and living and being in the now and just to, you know, I I've said this in my podcast a long time ago. I was really struggling with meditation, which everybody says I should be doing. So I just started going out for walks and in nature. Yeah. And my God, it's the same thing. You're just relaxing, your thoughts are coming in, you're looking at nature. And now I find that I can zone out all the time. But we're taught as children not to zone out. And I think it's wrong, because I think when you get to zone out, it means you can refresh yourself. Daydream is a beautiful thing to do.
Absolutely.
All my life I was told, don't daydream.
And now they're teaching meditation in schools.
Meditation is daydreaming. It's basically, that's what you want to try and do. Yeah. You want to go around your life daydreaming and just looking and being observing. And I loved getting on the tube now. I know this sounds bizarre to everyone, but I love getting on the tube, not listening to anything, not watching anything, just not reading a paper and just watching all the other humans. It's quite bizarre what we're all doing. None of us are engaged with life. We're all engaged in our machines and stuff.
Absolutely.
But there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. But it's nice to take a break from it.
Mm-hmm.
So... and do that. And remember, you're going to die one day. This is the most important question. And God, I can't wait for you to answer this, because you know more than the rest of us. What is the meaning of life?
Oh, if I only knew. I think I've watched so many people struggling with, what am I for? What am I for?
So what's the answer, Catherine?
And I think the answer is that we are for us. It's about just relishing the being, and that wisdom of be here now, that's it. It's just doing that repeatedly for however many million seconds you draw breath.
When you're about to die, for anyone who's not in there, coming towards their end of their life listening to this, when you're about to die, often do people get there and go, I can't wait to die, I'm looking forward to it?
You get a lot of, I'm ready now. Yeah, I'm ready now. It's okay. I can go now.
So it does feel that way for people.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think you've had a better life than the rest of us because you've been around this amazing thing you're doing?
It's really been very, very enriching. Yeah, I mean, it's not a competition, is it? But it's been a really life-enhancing thing. And what it's been about is seeing the absolute graciousness of people when all of the stuff is stripped away. That thing about being absolutely honest, that's what dying people do. There's no point in pretending anymore. What you see is what you get.
And my final question to you, it's quite poignant really, I suppose. I was talking to Mark a bit about this before you came over today. Do you think the funeral needs to be changed? I mean, they're so miserable, aren't they, and drab, and I'm talking probably about a pretty, you know, like a British style, where you get in a box and you go down the, you know, and you get cremated or you know, whatever it is. Do you think it's kind of boring, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It depends what we think a funeral is about.
Shouldn't it be a celebration of life?
Well, there are different views. And one of the views is that actually going to the place of lamentation is something that brings the village together, that brings us all together, united in our grieving. And if we try to do the jolly, wasn't she marvellous thing too early, we actually don't bottom out that pit that we really, really need to sit and stare at a bit.
All right.
So maybe what we need to do is a two-faced funeral, or maybe we need to invent something that's like a week of celebration where you start off with a lamentation and you end up with just the best party at the other end of it. Mm. Because they're both part of it, aren't they? And you don't want to not celebrate the magnificence of this person that you've lost. But actually your heart is really heavy and maybe so close to the death isn't the right time. I think it's really interesting, and I don't know the answer. Last week I was really, really poorly.
Just watching those boxes though, they go on the little thing and the curtains close.
It's so
does this really have to happen like this?
Or watching a coffin going down into a grave. It just is such a difficult thing to watch.
I don't know. I don't think I've watched many of those, only a couple, where you throw the earth on afterwards. Yeah. Oh, that's okay, I suppose. At least you're contributing, but just watching something.
Yeah, I don't see. I'm hatching a bit of a plan. So last week I was feeling really awful, and my husband came in from, can't remember where he'd been now, but he said, oh, I've got a leaflet for us. He looked really pleased with himself, and I'm feeling like three parts dead, and I'm up to here with paracetamol. And it was a woodland burials scheme that's starting quite near where we live. I just thought I might need that sooner than you know today. But it made me think that actually, yeah, I love the idea of giving our bodies back
yes, so
to
do
nature.
I. But I don't want to do it in one of those oak boxes.
Well,
I like them just
so,
to put...
Well, I've become a bit interested in felt making, and I'm thinking maybe one of my just projects would be to felt my own shroud.
See, I was thinking
yeah,
that.
That
rather
wouldn't
than spend
that be nice?
I was thinking that rather than spend all my money on... I quite like the idea of a 24-hour funeral.
Uh-huh.
I like that idea, but I quite like the idea of just being sort of in a cardboard box or something and put in the ground and just, you know... then I disintegrate and the worms eat me and all that sort of stuff and I go back into nature. That's what I quite like the idea
and,
of.
You know, lots and lots of other
part
societies
of
really do that. Yeah. I was in Kenya last summer and it's interesting talking to different people about what their traditions are around dying. And I noticed, because I'm a bit weird like that, that we didn't see any cemeteries. So we were out bumping along in a jeep in the Maasai Mara.
Yeah.
And I asked the driver whether it was okay to ask him about dying, because some cultural beliefs are that it's just not okay to talk about it. He said, no, that was okay. I could ask him about that. So he wasn't Maasai. He was from further north in Kenya. I said, there's no cemeteries. He said, well, why would we have cemeteries? He said, we only have cemeteries in the city for visitors, for foreigners, because when you die, you go back to your village. And even if you've lived your whole life in the city, you know where your village is.
Well, then what do they do with them?
And there you will be buried in the village place where they bury people, apart from the Maasai. And the Maasai have this wonderful, respectful, give-and-take relationship with nature, where they are still allowed to hunt, and they eat
right.
the animals that they hunt.
Yeah.
And at the end of their lives, they have... these fantastic craftsmen who come and wrap their body in animal fat
yeah.
and take them out into the Maasai Mara to be devoured by the beasts to give themselves back to the cycle
That's
of nature.
That's a good idea.
So now that would be a hell of a party, wouldn't it?
But there's 500,000 of us dying a
bit
year.
Messy. And,
but yeah,
bit
I
messy.
I don't suppose we'd... I'd quite like the idea as well of maybe they could put me on a boat. And then I'd get a guy and just, I don't know, like a muscular guy and just shorts with a bow and arrow and some flames.
Oh, Viking.
That's the one.
Yeah. You'd have to grow your beard back as well, wouldn't you?
That's quite like a Viking. I just don't want to go on that trolley thing behind some curtains. It's just rubbish.
Okay, we've all heard you say that now, Tim. Yeah, it won't happen.
Do anything apart from put me on that... What's those thing called? Like a
conveyor belt.
Conveyor belt. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's exactly the word I'm looking for. Conveyor belt. Anyway, listen, Catherine. Thank you so much for coming in and discussing this important subject. I think, and best of luck with your. What else are you doing? You obviously got the book out now. It's in paperback.
It's out in paperback this last week.
Last week, Sunday Times bestseller. So you're going to be doing lots more press and publicity and things.
More talks.
Good.
More meeting people and. Just the most lovely, lovely letters from readers. It's really, it's heartrending and heartwarming to hear the difference that it's making to people. And I do feel that maybe, you know, we're getting a lot more starfish thrown back by doing it as a book than you could ever do by each of us hoping to meet the right knowledgeable person in our life.
And as I say, it's very important because everybody who has said of coming on have all just kind of looked at me like, oh, I don't want to talk about that. So it's a great time to do this, to make sure we all embrace death and dying. It's important to do that, I think, for all our sanity.
I think you're right. So thank you so much for inviting me and chatting
Pleasure.
About
Pleasure, thank
it.
You. If you want to follow Catherine, it's Dr. Catherine Mannix, MANNIX, on Twitter and Instagram.
It is.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank
Cheers.
You. Cheers.
That was Catherine Mannix, with The End in Mind is her book. Do you know what? I thoroughly recommend reading it. I think we need to embrace death. As I say, it's 100% death rate.
It's doing your death voice, Tim.
I just, you know, I've been thinking a lot about death now, and there's a tiny bit of me. I'm so scared to say this because my parents, my family, are, oh, don't tempt fate, don't talk about death. But there's a bit of me which is sort of just a tiny. Don't get me wrong, I want to live, but there's a tiny bit of me goes, I wonder what happens at the end.
Sorry.
I wonder what happens. I just think it could be quite a nice experience. You often hear about people who have they die and they come back to life. They always say it's nice, don't they? They always say it's a lovely feeling. They don't say it's horrific and hellish. But I think the most fascinating thing about it is when you're on your deathbed, you start living, you start realizing it, all this stuff in our world means nothing. Absolutely nothing. You've got to analyze everything in your life and go, why am I doing that? Why,
except, you know, podcasts.
Except podcasts. But I mean, you know, if you're sort of like busy saving up for something and it means everything to you. And I think when you're young, you should do that. But as you transition into older life and adult life, you start thinking, what do I really value in life? And it's relationships. That's all it is. Relationships. Make sure you're not wasting all your time on other stuff and actually putting your time into relationships. I think that is the plan. Did you enjoy the podcast, Mark? Oh, we used the word enjoy before. It was interesting, wasn't it?
It was interesting. I found it of interest, yes. So I'll say that, yeah.
Any ideas about what you would like to do in your funeral?
Burnt, yeah, definitely burnt.
You want cremation?
Yeah. Yeah, Well, I thought we were getting away from those soft words. Burnt or buried?
Burnt or buried. No, it's only for the death or dying. I'm not sure. Oh, okay. I think cremated still a word, yeah, you can use.
Yeah. Cremated.
You want to be cremated?
Yeah.
Go behind the curtains. One of those things.
I won't be there.
You're not religious, are you, at all?
Don't give a monkeys. I won't be there, Tim.
You're not religious, are you?
No.
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 When you die...
Well, I don't bang on about it.
when you die, does the universe die?
Oh, I think it will... Yes, I think it will stop. Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming so.
Because it does. Yeah. It does though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, once you die, it doesn't matter whether the universe is here or not.
No, so you can fire me out of a cannon in a crotchless jumpsuit for all I give a fuck like.
Oh, that's a nice thought. All right. let's just remind you of our sponsors for the show. We've got Quooker. I love my Quooker, sorry. I always pronounce it wrong. Quooker, spelt Quooker, Quooker, pronounced Quooker. It's the hot water tap. It delivers 100, it's from Holland, you know, actually Netherlands, probably you have to say that, delivers 100 degree boiling water, plus hot and cold water and filtered cold water as well, or from the kitchen tap, saving water, energy, money and time, and far safer than a kettle. If you want to go and have a look at it, it's Quooker, or it's quooker.co.uk, but spelled Quooker, Quooker.co.uk for details. I was actually calling it Quooker the whole time. I've had one for, oh, I don't know, how long do you reckon I've had mine for?
How long have you been banging on about it for? I can't remember, Tim.
About 5 years, I think, yeah. I've had one for. I've absolutely loved it. And then I kept on calling it Quooker. And then the man came in because I decided to update my one. And he said, you know, it's called Quooker. And I went, what? What? I'd be calling it Quooker to everyone. It is Quooker. I think they're great. Thank you for sponsoring us. We're also sponsored by Beer 52, which is an ideal opportunity for you to get your hands on some free beer if you want to. It's craft beer from all around the world. Fraser, there at the company, and his lovely colleagues, they go traveling around the world, they find lovely beers, and they bring them home. I think I got sent a package once, which was all... from chefs who had basically found beers, and then, you know, they'd got 8 chefs together, had all picked a beer and stuck it, and they do things like that. It's really quite cool, but they're completely different flavors. Mark has got another one in his hand. What one have you got? Oh, that sounds good.
We've got the Milkshake IPA.
Milkshake
from the Booth Brewing. Oh, smells good. Just pour a...
Just pour me a touch. Oh, it's red. Hold on, that's red.
There you go. Pass that over to you there, Tim.
That's really red in colour. Okay. Oh, that's really sweet. Oh, I don't like that one. Is that a sour beer?
Oh, I like that. That's nice.
Is that a sour beer?
No, it's a milkshake. It's a blackcurrant milkshake IPA.
Oh, that's not nice.
Great sales pitch, Tim.
Well, no, that's the great thing about these beers. I drink it, but it's
I really like that.
Do you?
That's really unusual. When else are you going to try a beer like that?
Oh, that's not for me at all. It's sour. It's sour, isn't it? It's blackcurrant sour.
Yeah, but you like whiskey sours?
It's red in colour. Oh. Oh, it's really good. You know, that's like...
I think... See, I give that...
It's got me at the back of the thing.
Give that a couple of seconds. I think you're coming around to it.
No. Let me try that one more time. No, that's for you, mate. It's an interesting taste. Wow. I mean, that's complex, isn't it?
I think that's really interesting.
It's really interesting, yeah,
that's for sure.
Do you?
I do, actually.
That's the great thing about when you taste things, because sometimes you like them, sometimes you don't.
And yeah, but you've got mad taste buds. You don't like coriander or goat's cheese.
That's true. That's very true.
So, I like, really, you can't, as a sort of, as a spokesperson, you can't be trusted.
No, I'm not having that one. Oh, do you know what? I could drink a glass of it, but it's not. Well, you wouldn't go. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's all right. It's sour. That tastes like a sour beer to me. I don't like sour beers. Does that taste sour to you or not?
No, it tastes. Well, it's got sweet sour. It's got all different notes, isn't it?
Notes. Ooh. Anyway, this is from Beer 52, and they're. You know what they are? They're. What do you call them? A subscription service. Is that what it's called? And it's a craft beer discovery club, and they're the world's most popular. Beer 52, that's B-E-E-R, and 5-2, the number 5-2. And if you go to beer52.com/lovejoy, beer52.com/lovejoy, you can claim your free case today. That means you'll get 8 bottles, and then you have to pay the postage and packaging, which is $5.95. And then after that, you can cancel it if you want, but you basically get your 8 for free, which is good. You also get the magazine, and you get you also get a snack as well. Yeah. Okay.
We're going to keep that.
I think this is from. Where is it from? This one. I'm just reading here. Booth's Blackcurrant Milkshake IPA. Does it say where it's made? It's really unusual.
Belgium. You're coming round to it.
Yeah.
It's nice. I told you.
Okay. That's it for this week's podcast. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back very soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.